Hey, it's Scott, and welcome to Theology Lab. If the Apostles' Creed, that historic confession of the Christian faith, names some of the most essential things about our faith, what does it mean that it includes the statement, "I believe in Jesus Christ, who was born of a virgin"? Is the virgin birth a relevant theological idea for how we understand God and our Christian lives? I would imagine that for many of us, the simple line that the Son of God was born of a virgin, that if it's meant something significant to us, it's probably had to do with whether we should understand the virgin birth as historical or as an essential part of Christian belief. Now, I think that those questions matter, but very often they stop there, and we end up having a limited idea of the meaning and significance of the virgin birth. Follow me slowly here. Does it matter if God, who lives from eternity to eternity, came into the world through a female body and only a female body? Does that get a little bit more of your attention? When Amy Peeler posed this question, it certainly got mine. As you may know, Amy featured in this series earlier and for a conversation about whether or not we should think about God as male. This is a different conversation. It's short and to the point, and is very likely to get us thinking theological thoughts and their practical meaning in some very new ways. Amy's a New Testament scholar at Wheaton College. I've linked her book in the show notes. And one more fun thing to note here. If you'll be in the Boston area on November 23rd, you can hear from Amy Peeler live at a Holy Post event that we're hosting at High Rock Arlington Church. Amy will be in conversation with Holy Post host Esau McCauley. There's a link for tickets to that event in the show notes. If you're enjoying Theology Lab's podcast, take a moment, if you would, to follow the podcast or leave a review. That helps a lot. Here is my conversation with Amy Peeler about Jesus, Mary, and the significance of the virgin birth. And here's what something I found really intriguing about your book. When Mary or the virgin birth comes up, and when I have conversations with other people, very often it is this question of, well, one, do I have to believe the virgin birth to be a Christian? Right. Two, did it happen? You don't ignore those questions in the book. They do come up, but it's like there's this whole other range of theological meaning in the virgin birth that you tap into that I was just like, this is so interesting. Okay, so beyond like apologetic arguments, can you give us a sense of what's important? What do we gain from attending to the idea of the virgin birth?
Yes. So I was instructed really by some of the early debates about who is Jesus and what kind of claims are we making that he's God, right? It took several hundred years for our brothers and sisters in the past to figure out what exactly they're saying. And that is where the incarnation, even the virginal conception, became really important to emphasize this radical grace that God, the Son, who was eternal, all these claims that Jesus made about himself before Abraham was, "I am," God deigned or showed grace to be born. And so the baby that Mary bore was, in fact, the Son of God. One of the earliest debates is, what name should we call Mary? And she was ended up, the Council of Ephesus decided to call her God-bearer, or in Greek, Theotokos. And some people today hear that term like, oh, God-bearer, mother of God, that sounds like Mary's eternal or something. I said, oh, no, that's not what it means at all. In that context, it really was a way of honoring Jesus. So first and foremost, if we want to have a healthy Christology, fully God and fully human, then his birth, Jesus's birth, is a vital part of that. This is how God chose to send the Son into the world. And that goes all the way back to the earliest tradition, Paul's letter to the Galatians, which many of us New Testament people think that that's his first letter. And that's where we have the first statement, God sent forth his Son. How? Born of a woman, born under the law. And so you have that. Paul doesn't tell the Christmas story, right? But you have that assertion, even the writings of Paul, probably his earliest one. So it asserts the humanity of Jesus, that God by grace became human. But that, of course, was not the primary question that I was asking. I feel like my call, at least for the season of my life, is to speak to women and men about their value. And in Christian spaces in which I run, it has been true that many women question if they fully belong, if they are second-class citizens in Christianity, if Christianity is really a religion more for men. And so that was my motivating question. So in turning then to the virginal conception, it was surprising to me too, Scott. I didn't kind of know the things I would discover as I went through my exegesis. I kind of wrote a lot of Mary's story, the exegesis in the book, in the early months of 2018 when I was on a first sabbatical. And like every day was a treasure hunt in which I felt like I was finding gold. That was one of the sweetest times of research I've ever had in my life. And on this particular point, I found it incredibly profound and moving and really has become a bedrock of my own spiritual life. That God said, I can not save the world, but I'm going to decide to save and redeem the world. And I could do that in any way. God so chooses, right? We can't tell God what to do. And God said, I'm going to become incarnate. And moreover, I'm going to experience the fullness of human condition. I'm going to begin to save the world through pregnancy. I'm going to enter the world by taking the flesh of the woman, dwelling in her womb and being birthed from her. For me, in lots of different debates about the kind of place in women in Christianity, the fact that Mary really stands at the center of the Christian story by God's choosing is the definitive statement of God's valuing of women. Embodiment, their will, their agency, I know we might get into that, but this has been a non-negotiable touchstone to which I have returned now in many seasons and many challenges. And when I get confused or feel downtrodden, and then I just feel like I'm invited by God to say, but remember, Mary, I chose her, which means I also value you. And that's been a life changer for me.
When I was preparing for this conversation, I was talking with a couple other people that at one point I had used this line, or God indwelled in a woman. Mm-hmm. And they actually came back to me. They said, yes, but like, it's actually, think about even more than that, right? The person, mm-hmm. the woman said to me, think about God was nurtured by a
yes.
woman's body.
Right.
The infant was entirely vulnerable, and the infant being the divine, the second person of the Trinity, totally
yes.
dependent upon this woman. Do any of these images, like, do you think that there's mm-hmm. ways that these images can help us see one another differently, see who
that's
God
beautiful.
Is differently?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Wow, that's beautiful. And there's such riches there. If anyone has a chance to take a look at my book, there's a lot of footnotes. And one thing that I would highlight there is that Christian poets throughout the centuries have reached for words to try to capture this paradox of the incarnation, of the birth of God. I quote from Denise Levertov and Malcolm Guite, and one of my favorites from the 4th century, Ephraim the Syrian, has just reams and reams of poetry trying to express what we're speaking of here. So I think in some ways, it is a further reflection on Paul's Christ hymn in Philippians 2. Right? This epic poem of the Son being in the form of God, did not consider equality with God something to selfishly hold on to, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, of a slave. Well, how did he take that form? Yes, by being nurtured and by indwelling in her womb. But to return to your first question about virginal conception, all of that would be true if Joseph and Mary had a child and then God decided, okay, this is the child that will save the world. But God said, the vehicle that I will choose is the cultivation of her body alone. And so his humanity, his flesh, and this is doggedly asserted throughout the centuries of the church, right? Church fathers will not budge on this, that his tether to humanity is from her alone. In my more recent work, and this is not in the book, but this will be in volume 2 on which I'm working now, it's been really profound for me to recognize a bit of a comparison with Adam, right? Paul reflects on Adam in, say, texts like Romans 5 or 1 Corinthians 15, because God created Adam first, Adam is really the representative of humanity. It's Adam's sin that changes the world. If you read those passages, you might wonder, well, Eve was involved. You know, Eve had some culpability too. But Adam, because Adam is first, is referred to then really as the head of humanity. And that's developed in many theological circles. It seems to me then, and I'm still working this out, so some of our listeners might have ways to make this more clear, or maybe I'm just barking up the wrong tree, I'm not sure. But it seems to me that then in incarnation, new creation, God chooses to make a woman first. And from her body, the Son of God, his body is cultivated. And so at creation, you start with a man, and from him, the woman's body is drawn, Adam and Eve. In new creation, God chooses to start with a woman alone, and from her, the body of the Savior comes. So man, woman, woman, man. There is this powerful and beautiful and balanced chiasm in creation to new creation. So if we call Adam our federal or representative head in creation, would it be inappropriate to refer to Mary as our representative? She is the humanity that the Son of God cultivates and enters through. And so her representation of humanity is then the balance to Adam's. In creation, God chose to work with a man first. New creation, God chose to work with a woman first. And therefore, there's honor for both sexes in the whole of the story.
That is so interesting. I literally like the way you bring out how pivotal, literally pivotal, because she's at the very center. If you take the comparison with Adam and then to the way of Christ, she stands in the story. She stands in the very middle of the story. Let me go to this question here. There is criticism that is sometimes made about the virgin conception, that Mary, right, this angel shows up, the spirit hovers over Mary, and then she is all of a sudden pregnant. So there's this claim that she's coerced into conceiving Jesus. I'm wondering two things. Like, how do you respond to that criticism? And then in your response, what do you think we learn about how God relates and thinks about women in that.
And really, I would say, I'll get to this in a second, but all humans. I think the Annunciation story becomes a template. And actually, all traditions of the church have looked to the conversation between the angel and Mary as a story for how God the divine relates with all of humanity. So she becomes our exemplar. So you're right. I was surprised. I did not grow up realizing that across time, people have critiqued the Annunciation narrative as being like the gods of ancient Greece who would force themselves on women. I mean, you have some early kind of questions asked or rumors spread about the birth narratives. And of course, that would have been quite common in a first century context. You hear about a god and a woman gets pregnant, you're going to think of all of these myths. And as I state in the book, I'm continually impressed with Luke and Matthew's boldness in deciding to tell this story in this context. They could have gone the way of Mark and John and just not had a birth narrative at all, right? That was an option for them. But I believe under the provision of the Spirit, both of these evangelists said the story is worth telling. What I was intrigued to learn as well is that in modern critical scholarship, there are a number who have said either the story is all made up or, more weighty, this story is a divine rape. One of the most kind of provocative feminist critics, Mary Daly, would call Mary the total rape victim. And I mean, she was always using really intense language, but there are others. There are several articles in pretty recent editions of JBL, the Journal of Biblical Literature, which is really the flagship journal, to say, look at all the ways that there's coercion going on here. So those are one of the critiques that I wanted to listen to very carefully. So I didn't kind of go into the project wanting to just dismiss people who said something that was different than me. I really wanted to sit with it. But I also don't deny that my faith makes me like resistant to that idea, right? So I have some skin in this game. I acknowledge that as well. I don't come in as a neutral party. But in my exegesis, I believe that the way in which Mary is portrayed, her inquisitive character, she's thoughtful. She doesn't immediately, like some immature, plucky teenager, be like, oh, I get to bear the Messiah? Yes, please, right? She's disturbed and she asks questions. And I think maybe one of the most important points is that, yes, Gabriel states to her, you will bear the Messiah, you will name him, he will reign on the throne. But these are all in the future. They're not statements of, hey, guess what? You're already pregnant without your knowledge. I think that's quite important to recognize. And then as more information is given to her, as she begins to wonder about the nature of this pregnancy, her own virginity, then she's told, yes, truly, this child will be holy, called the Son of God in a way that has not ever been true previously, and told about Elizabeth. And then the angel says, nothing is impossible with God. That would have been a great moment for the angel just to leave the scene, right? That's kind of a mic drop moment. That's a great conclusion. Nothing is impossible to kind of say, hey, God can do whatever God wants. And so this is going to happen. That we have a few more verses in this narrative and that the next verses are her verbal response. I understand who I am. I want to serve God. She calls herself a female slave, and that's its own bucket of difficulty. And we really need to sit with the harshness of that term. But she owns it for herself. I want to be in this. I accept. Let this word be done in me. That she gives her verbal consent after her consideration, I think is a powerful attestation that this isn't forced, but chosen. And as I mentioned, all traditions, whether they agree on the power of God's sovereignty or human response, all of these theological debates that we have about how salvation plays out across the board, from Orthodox, Catholic, Reformed, Arminian, everyone reads this story as a freely chosen acceptance that Mary had agency. And I think that's incredibly powerful that there's a point of agreement there.
Yeah, you quote some pretty conservative scholars and some pretty progressive scholars who come forward and they say this. And it's very interesting because when you used to give this, you tend to this in chapter two, you really walk through the first chapters of Luke and the story with Mary. And I will just say one of the things that stood out to me is the way you highlight in Mary's response how she's almost leading the questioner. And I thought, oh my goodness, like with a slow reading and you see how she responds and her ways that she's puzzled, disturbed, and provocative in her questions. It really changes how you understand that scene. Let me ask one more question here about Mary. I do wonder about, you know, gender is a big topic right now. Does not attending to Mary's story have an impact on how we think about gender? I guess, I mean, I'm asking this negatively, like what do we miss out in thinking about gender and God and theology when we don't look at Mary? But maybe positively, what does looking at Mary's story possibly teach us about gender today?
Yes. So I'll start from my own tradition. So I grew up Southern Baptist in Oklahoma. I had a really healthy church and a great youth pastor. So a lot of good things. As I got into college, as was true in a lot of denominations and still is true today, the Southern Baptist Convention was having a lot of debates about gender. What roles should men and women play? That was very intense as I was coming into college. And that's when I also decided to be a biblical scholar. So I was very attentive to these things. And they almost always revolved and still revolve around particular Pauline texts. What does Paul say about the church that men and women cannot do? And I don't think that's a wrong thing. Those are important texts and they need to be attended to. But it felt like as I was kind of in that world that there was just this gridlock between, well, we interpret these passages this way, we interpret these passages this way. And I had a wonderful professor in graduate school, Beverly Gaventa, who's done some of her own work on Mary. Maybe you had her too, Scott. I'm not sure if she had left by the time you were there. Excellent. But she would tell us in seminars, if you come to a debate in the academic world or in the church world, ask a different question, like supersede the debate. Like if they're locked, they're maybe asking the wrong question. And as I reflected more about Mary, it began to dawn on me that maybe for those communities that are kind of always fighting about Paul, this is just a breath of fresh air to say, time out on that fight. Let's have a different conversation. Let's ask a different question. What does it mean that God chose to save the world starting with pregnancy? What does it mean that God allowed the son to be raised by and instructed by and influenced by his mother, even into his ministry? What does it mean that God allowed her to proclaim in the Magnificat a prophetic word that looked back to God's truth in the past and forward to the ministry of her son, that she was present at Pentecost? I think there's a really healthy new conversation that can happen when we say, what has God invited and empowered Mary to do? And what might that tell us about the roles of women? Important questions that we're still asking in many more conservative Protestant Christian spaces. Now, if I might very quickly, in writing this book, I hope it's evident that I really tried to learn and listen to Catholic and Orthodox theology. And wow, what riches did I discover there, and so many of the authors that I quote. But that would almost be evidence against the argument that I just made, because those are two communities who pay a lot of beautiful attention to Mary and have for thousands of years. And yet we look at how gender roles play out in their structures, and they're largely even more rigid and unchanging and not allowing women to do certain things than many Protestant spaces. So it is not the case that if we, to start thinking about Mary, this is a magic bullet, and then we'll have complete kind of mutual participation between men and women. No, it could be the case that even if she is elevated, and with all due respect to those rich theological systems, I do believe that in some ways, Mary is so elevated in Catholic and Orthodox thought that there's not then enough of a connection between her and anyone else for it to play out in what I think is the most biblically appropriate way in how we work together in the church. Now, I'm being very careful here, right? Anyone would kind of read my bio and know that I believe that men and women should do things together in church. Everyone is free to disagree with that. So I have some very good Catholic friends that I know right now, they would say, but we see it different. And I respect that. But the point I'm raising here is that Mary doesn't automatically mean you have mutuality. But I do think in Protestant spaces that haven't ever paid attention to her, this might be a fresh pathway to think and live differently.
I'm going to add one more question on Mary, if that's okay.
Sure.
Can you give us just a take or two on how the virgin birth, maybe thinking more about the incarnation, the divine word within Mary's womb, how does that have a bearing, an impact on women in ministry and women in ministering, communion and preaching? I'm just saying, because I noticed some interesting creative things that you say in this book that I really like, but can you speak to that?
Sure. So the realization, especially this is kind of laid out in the chapter on embodiment and birth, the fact that women in Jewish law were considered impure after they had a baby. And again, I think probably many of your listeners would understand that in Jewish law, impurity doesn't mean that you're sinful or bad. You're just not holy, not set apart. You can't come to the temple. You can't be proximate to the presence of God, not because God doesn't like you, but because God is totally pure and holy, and you have to go through all the rituals to be clean. So Mary, in this state of being a parturient, right, as women would be unclean after birth, it was fascinating to me that as Luke tells the account of their first trip to the temple when they dedicate Jesus, this is Luke chapter 2, he notes that they're coming to the temple both to dedicate Jesus and also for Mary to do her purification rites. I mean, this is the intriguing thing about Luke. He's dominantly writing kind of with Hellenistic Greco-Roman ideas, but he's very clear that Mary and Joseph and Jesus keep the Jewish law. They never kind of let, right? There's very high respect for the Jewish law. So she's following the rules, right? It's not as if she tries to march into the temple and she's like, I'm the mother of the Son of God. I did. No, she like does her purity ritual on the same day that any other woman would do it who had a baby when she did. But in reflecting on that, it became quite powerful to me to realize that as she's in that state of impurity, what is she doing? She's nursing Jesus and swaddling him and holding him. And would we not say that the body of the Son of God would be the most holy thing that has ever existed on earth? If the priests had to put bells on their ankles to go into the Holy of Holies when just the kind of glory would descend, how much more so is Mary encountering the holy when she nurses and swaddles the very body of God? And so to me, this is a pronouncement that God has said women are worthy to be close to the holy. Now, in my tradition to which I have now moved, I'm now Episcopalian, in these spaces, Anglican, Catholic, and Orthodox, it's really intriguing to me. They don't care if women preach. But in the Baptist or Presbyterian worlds, they really care that women can't preach. So, I mean, it's just kind of interesting to me that communities who have very strict ideas about what women can't do don't agree on what that thing is that women can't do. That's kind of interesting. But on this kind of more sacramental side, instructed by friends who write about the Eucharist, primarily my buddy James Arcadi, who I quote here, he's saying if the Eucharist, then we claim in a mysterious way, as this meal is consecrated, it becomes the body and blood of Jesus. So if God has said a woman can hold and bear my very Son, wouldn't it seem inconsistent if God would say, but henceforth, women can never touch the body that by the power of the Spirit is his and multiplied in the meal? That seems deeply incoherent to me. And so I think the incarnation provides, I think, the best argument for why women are allowed and welcomed at the table. And Scott, if I might be personal for a bit, that I allude to in just the same book, as I was writing this, especially reading for weeks and months and years, really, authors who would say women are not allowed in this space. Women cannot come this close to the holy. And as I'm doing that week by week, then every Sunday I'm standing at this altar and I would be and continue to be so incredibly moved that God would say, no matter what all of them say, look at Mary, look at Jesus. I said that you're welcome here. You're welcome to bless this meal. And that persists for me pretty much every week. I know that many people say I don't deserve to stand there, and yet God says, I'm welcome.
That is so powerful. And I think that the way that you describe, you know, Mary caring for the divine word, that it might even help us think, like, when I'm reading scripture, when I'm thinking about moral, ethical decisions, it's not merely just like looking to see what is there a passage that speaks directly to this in it either says do something, don't do something. I see you saying there's actually a way that we should be reading this text and looking at the embodied actions of God, because they tell us about the value of all people. They tell us about God entering into and bringing women nearer to him than we could even really imagine, in surprising ways at the very least. So I appreciate
that. Can I just say really, really quick, because this is really important to me. So I'm speaking in situations where women have been prevented. And so I am making argument why they're present. But I would never want anyone to imagine that then I'm saying that men are not welcome, right? That there is really a beautiful, I am so privileged to serve at a church with a male priest and then myself. And every Sunday, whoever is celebrating and getting to say the words, and the moments in which we present the gifts to the church, the other one of us will join the other at the table and we both hand out the gifts together. And that, I think, is the picture that God's table is so abundant. It's not a zero-sum game that if you invite women in, then you push men out.
Yeah.
No, like there's plenty of room. There's plenty of room for the gifts of all. And so to also affirm that I believe this is very valuing for men because it really brings them back into the creational stewardship that God imagined that men and women would share together. And I think that's more healthy than doing things on their own or not experiencing the support of their sisters. So it's good for both of us when women are valued.